Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Greg Graffin, the lead singer of the venerable punk band Bad Religion, who is also, who knew, an evolutionary biologist. He's out with a new book, Anarchy Evolution, which is about his dual life and interests. Then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Jeffrey Sachs, who is also out with a new book, this called The Price of Civilization, on the rotten corruption that is the USA today. Yes, that Jeffrey Sachs, once known as Dr. Shock. As a friend of mine said recently, Sachs is now talking like Ralph Nader. I'll have more to say about this mysterious evolution later. Before that, some words in the news. The European situation spun more deeply into crisis this week. Interest rates on 10-year Italian government bonds crossed the spooky 7% barrier, now yielding 5 points more than comparable German bonds. A year ago, Italian bonds yielded 4.3%, less than 2 points above German rates. In the jargon of the markets, this blowout in Italian spreads is a sign of investor panic. On paper, Italy shouldn't be so bad off. Its budget is in decent shape, and Italians have plenty of domestic savings, more than enough to cover the government's financing needs. The joke is that Italians don't pay taxes, they buy government bonds instead. Sure, the Italian economy isn't mighty in a German way, but in more normal circumstances, it would be able to continue to put one foot in front of another. But these are not normal circs, of course. Italy is the third largest economy in the Eurozone, the eighth largest in the world. In other words, a major problem should it blow up, financially speaking. If capital flees Italy and is unable to service its debt, then the euro will certainly fall apart. That might not be unreasonable in the long term, but in the short, it would mean more turmoil and more recession. And if banks get scared and stop lending to each other, well, it's 2008 all over again, not just for Europe, but the entire world. And as I'm recording this, news came in that Belgium's debt had just been downgraded by Standard & Poor's, deepening the anxieties. Belgium is a heavily indebted, ethnically divided country that can't put together a government, so the downgrade isn't exactly a surprise, and it does remain at AA. But the markdown underscores the fact that the crisis is moving from the periphery towards the core of Europe. Further evidence that the crisis is moving from the periphery towards the core is that Germany had a rocky bond auction earlier this week, meaning sluggish demand for its debt. Though the bond auction wasn't a failure, it was an unnerving sign that even the Teutonic core is shaking. The silver lining of this is that Germany might finally wake up to the fact that it needs to show some leadership and cobble together some sort of bailout, meaning an orchestrated debt write-off with German financial assistance, or face total meltdown in the old world. Meanwhile, the U.S. Deficit Super Commission collapsed, unable to come up with anything. Dems were willing to cut Social Security and Medicare, but Republicans wouldn't agree to tax increases. This is basically good news. It will keep austerity at bay for a little while longer. We do have to worry about the automatic spending cuts that this failure is supposed to trigger, though it's hard to imagine Congress sitting back and letting those happen. But the cuts would shield Social Security and Medicare and take a reasonable slice out of the Pentagon. That, plus the likely expiration of the Bush tax cuts, would yield a somewhat more progressive outcome than what this committee was likely to come up with. But despite the groans of deficit hawks over the commission's failure, the bond market yawned on the news. In fact, because of the euro crisis, U.S. Treasury bonds now yield less than comparable German bonds. A month ago, the U.S. Treasury had to pay more than its German counterpart. One reason for this is that panicked investors are fleeing European assets and dumping their proceeds into American assets. If the so-called bond market vigilantes, remember them, were really worried about fiscal ruin in the U.S., we'd be seeing our interest rates rise somewhere between gently and dramatically. But they're not. They're drifting lower. So much for the U.S. equals Greece scenario. More on all this next week. Back with Greg Graffin after a musical break.
Hey, brother Christian, with your high and mighty heiress, your action speaks aloud, I can't hear a word you're saying. Hey, sister, bleeding heart, with all of your compassion, your labors do the hurt, but can't assuage the patient. Science with your perfect rules of measure, can you improve this place with the data that you gather? Hey, Mother Mercy, can your life improve forever? Is your fecundity a gem or a treasure?
That was a bit of I Want to Conquer the World by Bad Religion. The lead singer of that band, Greg Graffin, is just out with the paperback edition of a book called Anarchy Evolution, Faith, Science, and Bad Religion in a World Without God, published by Harper Perennial. Graffin co-founded the big-time punk band Bad Religion in 1979, and they're still around more than 30 years later. He's also got a PhD in evolutionary biology and teaches that subject at UCLA. Here he is to talk about all that, Greg Graffin. Welcome, Greg Graffin. So I guess you don't really want to conquer the world and give all the idiots a brand new religion then, huh?
No, that line was said with a bit of irony in it.
I figured so. So I got to say, there aren't too many evolutionary biologists who are also distinguished punk rockers. I guess the drummer from Queen, right, is an astrophysicist, but I don't know that there are many other folks in the rock and roll world who have these dual interests. But I'm just in time terms, how have you balanced these two careers?
Well, it's become increasingly difficult. I mean, when I was a high school kid and starting out in Bad Religion, you know, I sort of discovered a love of evolution, and I wanted to study more about evolution. So I was learning as I went along, and also learning about songwriting, and it was sort of an era of discovery. After a certain number of years doing that side by side, both music and studying science, I became, you know, I kept elevating our game in Bad Religion and getting better becoming better songwriters, getting better at performing, going on tour, and in academia, I went on to get a PhD. At that point, they don't call you a student anymore. Now you're supposed to be an expert. So at this stage of the game, I'm not learning anymore, and it's a very challenging time to continue to do good work in music as well as academia. But I guess it just means that, you know, I've had to put certain projects on the back burner. Some Bad Religion fans wonder why it takes 3 years now to put out a record. Well, part of that is because I'm also developing, you know, my career in writing books and whatnot. So I guess it means in order to balance the two, you've got to, first of all, take yourself seriously, accept your own shortcomings, and realize that each one is a learning curve, and it's going to take some time.
You didn't grow up in a religious household, although your great-grandfather was a fundamentalist theologian, right?
That's correct, yeah. It turns out in my own personal family archives, one of the great heroes of our family was my great-grandfather. His name was E.M. Zur, and he went around the country running Bible discussions and Bible groups that would take him to communities all around the United States. And he would come to town and set up shop for a couple days, and people would get together and study the Bible. And it's kind of weird. I do the same thing, except it's not with a religious. You know, he essentially was going on tour three generations before I went on tour. But we now I go around the country and come into town and give concerts. So it's kind of interesting, the idea, maybe the wanderlust that is some kind of a genetic component in the family.
Well, you're no fan of religion. You're also not entirely comfortable with the concept of atheism. Why is that?
Well, here's the thing. There's a very active discussion going on in this country about atheism and people rallying around the atheist credo. The problem is atheism doesn't really say much about what you do believe in. It says, I don't believe in God, but I believe that I prefer to call myself a naturalist. Because I think if you say you're a naturalist, it actually says it's a statement about what you do believe in. And, you know, I think atheists are certainly the books that have sort of typified the genre of atheist writing are certainly well-written, interesting, and they do provide a lot of clarity on what these people believe. It's not, I don't think it's attractive to me as someone who's been in a band called Bad Religion. I don't think it's very attractive to create a religion around atheism. It's not interesting in the least.
Now, it's often said that scientists are privately very religious. I mean, a lot of religious people will say that there's no contradiction between religion and science. You actually did some polling of some of your colleagues. What did you find out in that research?
Yes, well, I did a study on evolutionary biologists where I pulled what I would consider the leading evolutionists in the world. And it's not just me who would make that qualification. I used as a criterion membership in the National Academy of Sciences or any of these honorific societies worldwide. And across the boards, what I found was that almost everyone who calls themselves an evolutionist also is what we would describe as a naturalist, someone who believes that the universe is made up of matter, that there's no such thing as non-material properties in the world, and that things like life after death and miracles and ghosts are non-existent. So almost all of them believe in the material universe and that there's no basis for a belief in the supernatural. And when asked if religion and science are compatible, well, then you'd be surprised, because I actually expected, given this belief in the material properties and in the rejection of most of the things that religions find absolutely fundamental, namely religions and the presence of incorporeal spirits and ghosts and whatnot, that the two would be mutually exclusive. But in fact, there's a significant proportion of these naturalists who say there's no conflict at all. In fact, most of them, the percentage is in the 80% range, think that you can find compatibilism between religion and evolution. And the way they do this, of course, is they believe that religion is a product of natural selection, so that religion comes out of this evolutionary phenomenon of social organisms, namely, you know, the cultural evolution, the sociobiological evolution of humans is what created religion. Now, that is highly contentious and very offensive to anybody who's not a naturalist and who is a religiously minded person, because it suggests that in order to understand your religion, you've got to study evolution.
Yeah, this brings up two issues. One is your discomfort with the concept of natural selection. You're not a big fan of that idea, necessarily.
To say I'm not a fan of natural selection is a little bit mischaracterizing my position. I teach evolution at the university level, so obviously natural selection is an important part of what I teach. But to say that natural selection is everything that's important about evolution is not adequate. It's not accurate. It's not what I see as my worldview. Part of the reason that I called the book Anarchy Evolution was obviously a quick way of describing the two things in my life: anarchy as a symbol of punk rock, and evolution as a symbol of the science that I've been studying these years. But also, the words together mean something to me. Anarchy evolution. It means that my view of evolution is a lot less law-like than many evolutionists believe. I don't think natural selection is the fundamental and only principle driving biodiversity. And because of that, I'm often challenged and to provide other mechanisms of law-like principles that created biodiverse world that we see. And for that, obviously, that's a much bigger topic, a much more difficult concept, but there's an increasing body of scientists now who are acknowledging that natural selection only plays a part of the explanation of biodiversity, and that there are other things involved in it as well. And those other things are the ones I would like to pursue more.
I'm speaking with Greg Graffin, who is the lead singer of Bad Religion, but also an evolutionary biologist and author of the book Anarchy Evolution, just out from Harper. Well, what are some of those things?
So that's where the book gets speculative, and yet I'm trying to draw on my own personal development and evolution to make some sense of it. Now, part of that requires the understanding that science is a narrative, just like the Bible is a narrative. Now, some people have a problem with that because they think, how can science be like the Bible? But part of my story is that the world didn't make sense to me as a kid because I was not taught the stories of the Bible. I didn't have a creation myth. I didn't have an understanding of the reasons for, why should I feel specially created. I didn't have any reasons or understanding of empathy in this world, or I didn't understand how I should treat my enemies, for instance. So all these things that most kids learn in Sunday school, I had none. When the world started to make sense to me, it was in high school when I discovered evolution, and my mom gave me a book on evolution, and the world slowly, through studying natural science, the world started to make sense to me. And that's part of what I detail in the book, is how that picture started to become clear. So I beg the reader to indulge me in that one criterion, that science is also a narrative. It can form a narrative. And if we look at the traditional way that evolution is taught, it focuses primarily on the narrative that there is a struggle for existence and that the fittest shall survive and that all of nature can be explained under this fairly narrow-minded narrative. And the history of evolution then has been a history of refinements in Darwin's theory, which was actually quite broad and had other mechanisms in it as well, other than natural selection. And the refinements ended up being so narrow that most people have just replaced the narrative of God with the narrative of natural selection.
That,
but
doesn't some of that bleed over?
Natural selection explains everything. It doesn't explain anything. So, so we cannot explain all sources of genetic variation, for instance, as the result of natural selection. There's an inherent paradox in natural selection thinking, and that is, if only the fittest are selected, if only the most beneficial variants are selected, then why does so much variation occur in nature? Why isn't there perfectly fit organisms in nature? Why does nature allow the unfit to survive and reproduce as well?
Doesn't some of this bleed over from economics? Natural selection is kind of the natural justification for a competitive structure to economic society?
Well, certainly natural selection has been used to justify certain social phenomena, and as is well known, it's been used in negative ways as well. And part of my problem with natural selection is that in order for it to function, we have to define the purpose of an adaptation. And we don't necessarily know what the purpose is of many social phenomena that we see. And because of that, you can almost, it's almost open-ended to say that natural selection is the cause, because all you have to do is choose a purpose, and then you can create a myth to go around it explained by natural selection.
When you read stories in the popular press, they often use evolutionary biology or evolutionary psychology to explain all kinds of phenomena like relations between the sexes, dating, the manners of clothes. I mean, it seems like people try to use this as an all-purpose explanation for social life. And similarly, you get all these genetic explanations of, again, the difference between the sexes, that it's all hardwired. How do you feel about those kinds of uses of biology and evolution?
Well, I challenge my students to think completely opposite of what they've been told, just for discussion purposes. And you're right, evolutionary psychology has gotten very popular because you can explain, like I just said, as long as you find a purpose, you can explain it as abiding by the law-like nature of evolution and natural selection. And the way I challenge them is to say the following. What if a certain trait is perpetuated in a population simply because it's cool? In other words, humans make choices all the time. And what if, and even though we know that, for instance, hair color has, or skin color is a more controversial one, we know that skin color has certain correlations to environmental parameters, right? I mean, if you have more melanin in your skin, if you're darker skinned, you have more protection against the sun. But what if that trait was perpetuated, meaning it was passed on from generation to generation, not because of some kind of a natural process like exposure to the sun, but simply because women found it more attractive. And women were able to choose those mates who had the darker skin because they were, it was a more attractive trait. Well, then that bypasses the entire argument of natural selection. It goes to something that Darwin called sexual selection, or I would call it cultural selection. And that's a much more interesting topic, but incredibly difficult to get a grasp on, as opposed to exposure to the sun. And how do we tease those two things apart? Well, it's very difficult. But that's an example of a trait that can be passed along and have nothing to do with the law-like nature of natural selection.
And we're running low on time, but we haven't talked very much about music. But how has your study of evolution influenced your music, if at all?
Well, you know, and I have to say that I guess at heart I'm an artist. And I believe that there is a creative way to do science. And in fact, in the book, I spend a large chapter talking about creativity. And I would say that the two have been mutually influential on each of the streams of my career path. Our Bad Religion songs have always been sort of the philosophical bent. Even in high school, I was not interested in writing love songs. I was interested, along with my co-writer, Brett Gerwitz. We always were kind of like the science nerds, the guys who liked philosophy, and we liked talking about large, big-picture concepts. And we infused those ideas into our songwriting. And as I learned more about science, I was able to use better metaphors, and I think better understand the world, because as I said earlier, my worldview became more coherent as I studied science. But likewise, you know, the process of making music and the process of creativity has influenced the way that I look at the natural world. And I see this bounty in the natural world of diversity and variation. And instead of looking at certain variants as deleterious or certain variants as not fit, I look at the variants in nature, the variations that I see in biodiversity, and I think that is the real engine of evolution. And where that comes from is rather mysterious, and that's what I think all students should be focused on, is the origin of variation in nature. And I think that ultimately came from my creative enterprise in music.
That was Greg Graffin, lead singer of Bad Religion and an evolutionary biologist. His book, Anarchy Evolution, Faith, Science, and Bad Religion in a World Without God, is just out in paperback from Harper Perennial. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back with Jeffrey Sachs after a musical break.
I'm a sensitive man. You can hear that in my song. I'm a sensitive man. Your first impressions could steer you wrong. Sincerely, my one desire is to make you happy again. But I can't begin until you let me back in. I'm a sensitive man. I'm a sensitive man. You can hear that in my song. I'm a sensitive man. Your first impressions might well steer you wrong.
That was some of Nick Lowe's Sensitive Man from his newish CD, The Old Magic. My next guest is the economist Jeffrey Sachs. Sachs teaches at Columbia University, where he directs the Earth Institute, a multidisciplinary center that gathers together social and natural scientists and policy wonks to devise fresh approaches to poverty, environmental degradation, and disease. Sachs is a problematic guy. He rocketed to fame in the mid-1980s when he helped engineer the shock therapy, a term he hates, that took Bolivia's inflation from 20,000% a year to zero, practically overnight, while leaving Bolivia still a very poor country. As the 1980s turned into the 1990s, he advised governments in Eastern Europe and Russia how to turn capitalist practically overnight. These changes caused enormous social dislocation and mass impoverishment. Sachs denies any responsibility for those bad outcomes. In fact, when I interviewed him 10 years ago, he blamed the Russians for not following his advice. Many people who worked with him at the time regarded him as an arrogant, know-it-all outsider who applied textbook economics mechanically to societies that he didn't understand. But over the last 10 years, Sachs has changed. He denies that he's changed, but most outsiders think he did. He has become more and more critical of economic orthodoxy, both in the poorer parts of the world and now increasingly in the U.S. As you will hear, he's very critical of the oligarchy that's run the U.S. into the ground, using terms not unfamiliar to listeners to this show. For an in-depth look at Sachs' evolution, see my review of his previous book on my website at Left Business Observer, that's all one word, leftbusinessobserver.com. So what are we to make of this? Some of my friends and colleagues think that Sachs should do penance for his past before we applaud his current work. Others think that acting as a high-profile critic of orthodoxy is penance in itself. I thought I'd lay out the dilemma before playing the interview. We report, you decide. Jeffrey Sachs, whose new book from Random House is called The Price of Civilization. Welcome, Jeffrey Sachs. I saw you down at Occupy Wall Street the other week. What do you make of this thing?
I think in 9 weeks now, it's changed the discussion in America, and very much for the good, because basically for 30 years we did not talk in this country enough about the growing inequality, about the impunity at the top of the power structure, about the intertwining of money and politics. Many Americans were feeling all of this, but Occupy Wall Street has galvanized it. It's also clear that there's a certain brittleness, of course, in the power structures in America, because even protests in a single park in Manhattan have really unnerved a lot of people. And all over the country, we're also seeing crackdowns right now, shocking kinds of crackdowns, as we saw this past weekend at UC Davis.
Why do you think this is provoking this kind of reaction? It seems to me, well, part of my diagnosis of what's wrong with this country is that the American elite has gotten rather fat and complacent and really unused to any kind of challenge. Is this what's behind this reaction?
I think absolutely. The top has not only been arrogant, not only been given everything demanded, but they came to act with almost sheer impunity in recent years. One of the most important aspects of the Occupy Wall Street movement is not that the rich are super rich only, but the fact that there's been a lot of illegality on their part to get this way. And that's a kind of sense that you can break the law, and then you can get bailed out, and then after you get bailed out, you can have a free pass and, ostensibly go back to the kind of behavior as before. So when this movement came, clearly the Wall Street leaders, the politicians in Washington, the right-wing media pundits, they don't know how to respond to all of this, and they've said one idiotic thing after another, like when Eric Cantor called these young people a mob when Newt Gingrich this past weekend railed against them. Get a job. Go take a bath. I mean, this is disgusting, patently absurd, nasty. Or when you have a crackdown, as you did on the campus of University of California, Then the police brazenly lie about what they did, not really understanding that in our day and age, you can say whatever you want, but there are going to be 50 cameras taking the pictures showing what liars they are.
When Obama was elected in 2008, he was put into office by a lot of people who expected a more peaceful, more egalitarian world. They haven't gotten either of those things. What did disappointments in his the nature of his rule have to do with the emergence of this movement, do you suppose?
Look, I'll tell you from my point of view, as yet another person who supported President Obama, who voted for him, who expected something better, even before the 2008 election, there was an incredibly worrisome sign, and that was that the day or days after the financial crash in September 2008, in the heat of the campaign, there was Senator Obama, candidate Obama, sitting next to Robert Rubin as his advisor on the financial crisis. Rubin, you'll recall, came from Goldman Sachs. He was then directly Treasury Secretary, or he was head of the National Economic Council. Then he was Treasury Secretary. He oversaw the deregulation of the financial markets that allowed the conglomerate Citigroup to be formed, and he became director of Citigroup straight from the Treasury. Then he made $126 million. Then Citigroup collapsed and also committed crimes along the way. And then Rubin said, I'm not responsible, and found himself sitting next to the candidate and soon-to-be president of the United States. What does this tell us? It tells us that the intertwining of power and money is so strong in the United States that it is, of course, even more than the revolving door. There is no door. There's just one continuous linkage over the last two decades between Wall Street and the White House, and it's led us to disaster. And what the Occupy movement is saying is the 99% would actually like our democracy back. Thank you.
You've spent much of your professional life studying the poorer regions of the world. Now you're turning your attention to the United States. Do you see any similarities in the diagnosis?
Of course I do. One of the great shocks for me when I started out my work more than a quarter century ago in Latin America was the extreme inequality between the super rich and the poor in Latin America. And I saw how that deranged politics, how the right would favor crackdowns, how the left, because it could not get normal policy making, would often come into office and favor populistic policies that had no staying power. And the region became very, very unstable. Then I watched, by the way, as Latin America started to get its act together by investing in education and broadening the democracy when it left the military rule of the 1970s and early 80s. In the United States, we're seeing something almost the opposite, which is that what was a middle-class society that I was born and raised in, where there was a sense that everybody belongs to the middle class, now is itself fragmenting into this massive inequality, and I'm seeing the same kind of political instability starting to take hold that we used to gawk at when it occurred in South America. This is extremely dangerous. We're also, and what I also see all over the world, is countries that are surpassing the United States in educational quality, in competitiveness, in the quality of infrastructure, in the use of broadband, which we invented, basically, inventing the Internet. But it's such a remarkable and effective technology that it's, of course, available to anyone in the world, and we're watching countries like Korea use it for massive improvements of productivity and economic growth, whereas in the United States, we're actually laggards.
What happened? How did we get into this sorry pass?
Well, I tried to figure that out in my book, The Price of Civilization, and as I looked at the financial crisis and then its antecedents in financial deregulation, which after all happened during the Clinton era, and then the antecedents of that, which took us back another decade, I came to the view that our real turning point was January 20, 1981, if I could put it that way. That was the day that Ronald Reagan came into the presidency. And he came into the presidency with an absolutely extraordinary, unprecedented, and dangerous idea. He said famously on that day that government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem. And Reagan really initiated an anti-government fervor that has gone on for 30 years, taking away the foundations of productivity, decency, and environmental protection that any society needs. It became bipartisan because powerful interest groups at the top of our society, Wall Street, Big Oil, the private health insurance industry, the infamous military-industrial complex, all financed the politicians of both parties and basically took over the levers of power, what I think is accurate to call a corporatocracy rather than a democracy. So for 30 years, we've been on a particular jag of slashing taxes at the top and slashing government for everybody else. This has gone on through Republicans who started it. It's gone on through Democrats like Clinton and like Obama, who promised the opposite and has delivered basically the same. And I think the Occupy movement is the very first time when we have a real beginning of a mass politics to put us in a different direction. It's, of course, early days. We're 9 weeks into this. But I think that it is a symptom this time coming from the bottom, not coming from a slick campaign, but coming from the population itself.
I'm speaking with Jeffrey Sachs, author of The Price of Civilization, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. But if we step back to 1981, the Reagan Revolution or counter-revolution was in large part a response to some economic problems of the 1970s, stagnation and inflation, which were not supposed to occur together according to economic orthodoxy at the time. So, you know, the economics profession was kind of confused and came up with a new approach, which was deregulatory, monetarist, austere, and political system came up with a similar approach. How would you have diagnosed the problems of the 70s and done something differently about them?
You've got it exactly right that the 70s was a very unnerving period for America and actually for much of the world. We had the oil price shocks, the rise of OPEC, the beginnings of really tough competition for the U.S. Auto industry from Japan initially. We felt something was really deeply wrong. Of course, we also had Watergate, the disaster of Vietnam drawing to ignominious close in 1975, the Iranian Revolution and the hostage taking. It was a miserable decade, and it felt that way. When Reagan came in, he made a diagnosis. His diagnosis was the fault is government. It was a preposterous diagnosis, in my opinion, but it was, as you said, a response to unease. I think when we look back especially, we can see that what was happening in the 1970s was the beginning of the new era that we are so deeply living in and shaken by right now, which is globalization. The world was coming together in a single global economy. Countries that were not ever considered competitors to the United States suddenly were tough competitors. It started with Japan, but of course today it's China. And instead of beating down government, had we been smart, we would have said, we have new serious problems here. We have tough competition. We have a loss of employment in manufacturing to foreign countries, because after all, it was in 1979 that our manufacturing employment peaked and has been in massive retreat since then. And we would have said, we need government to become more competitive, to make sure that our kids can get through post-secondary school skills programs, whether it's a bachelor's degree, whether it's advanced certificate degrees in technology. But we, instead of responding to globalization effectively as a society saying, yeah, we can take this on, we simply went after the things that Reagan preached, and they were slash taxes for the rich, slash government for everybody, deregulate the financial sector, deregulate and stop protecting the environment, basically turn government over to the corporate sector. And that was in 81. We've been 30 years into this right now. What Reagan started went through. So we're living with the results of that. The taxes did come down at the top. Government services and investments fell sharply outside of the military and outside of the transfer programs. I'm talking about spending on education, science, technology, infrastructure, rebuilding roads, protecting the environment, energy systems. All of that, as a share of national income, fell very sharply. And, of course, we had financial deregulation. So we're living through a kind of diagnosis and prescription which has proved to be an utter disaster. And it's time to get back to a kind of normal understanding which we once had, which is that a market economy by itself cannot be prosperous, it can't be fair, and it certainly can't protect the environment. For that, you need the effective role of government alongside. Stop demonizing government, start making it work properly, and start making the rich pay for it.
Now, there's a diagnosis that would suggest that the American rich today, the corporate elite, the Wall Street elite, have pretty much divorced themselves from the interests of the larger society. Their interests are abroad. They're getting more and more of their profits abroad rising Asia, and they're pretty willing to throw half or three quarters of the American population to the wolves. Is that kind of an irreversible development?
I remember being quite taken when a chairman of the board of one of the world's largest companies said to me in a question that I had about the unbelievably greedy compensation packages that CEOs effectively pay themselves in our country because they appoint the compensation committees that give them their compensation. And I said, how can it be that in the United States the CEOs are taking $10, $20, $30 million a year, even as their companies often are being driven into the ground, whereas in Northern Europe, a part of the world I really admire, that would be considered, very odd behavior. He said, look, our companies are bigger than countries, even bigger than the United States right now. We don't have allegiance to the United States as a company. We don't have a home base. We have a world base. So there is no sense of shame or responsibility to local social norms in the United States right now. And I think that this is very telling. It's not only that the companies are earning more profits abroad, it's also that they are cooking the books to declare more profits abroad, again, in connivance with the politicians, because some of our biggest companies use accounting tricks, so-called transfer pricing, so that they can say, oh, those profits were actually made in the Cayman Islands. Those profits were actually made in Bermuda. Google, for example, does this. It has an agreement with the IRS that allows a shell company in Bermuda to hold the intellectual property of Google for international transactions so that when revenues are earned abroad, those revenues are then charged for intellectual property in the Cayman Islands. This has the effect of shifting the accounting profits to the Caymans, which have no income tax. And it allows a company like Google and there are many, many others to say, oh, we don't have income taxes. That money was earned in a tax-free haven. So this is the kind of corporate behavior that I don't, expect corporations to try to use what means they can within the law, perhaps. I want them to get out of the lobbying business, but especially I want our democracy to stop handing over billions of dollars to the corporations and start getting them to pay their bills. It's no coincidence that corporate taxes as a share of national income are at all-time lows right now, at 1.5% of our national income, when we should be collecting roughly twice that amount.
Are we looking forward to something like a Haitian model? I mean, our elites are not moving to Mumbai or to Shanghai. They're staying on the Upper East Side and Palo Alto. They can only wall themselves off so much. But are we going to look to some sort of Haitian model where they live in walled compounds?
Well, think that they would understand another thing, which is some of these elites, like David Koch, who is one of the two Koch brothers who owns Koch Industries, the biggest private oil company in the United States. Each of the brothers is worth $25 billion. They finance all measure of right-wing causes right now. They propagandize against climate change. You know, they're the ones that are behind all of the, or not all, but a lot of the misinformation about climate change, trying to convince Americans that it's a scientific hoax. However they wall themselves off, they can't wall themselves off from the climate, and they certainly can't protect their children and their family and from the future consequences. So there's a certain recklessness and rapacious greed that blinds even them to even their most narrow self-interest. So what kind of world do they think they're creating for their children, for example? A world of profound instability. I don't care how many helicopters are ferrying them to and from their gated communities. If the world's unstable, they're creating a miserable place for their children. And alas, that's what they're doing right now in this blind pursuit of a higher ranking on a Forbes billionaire list, because that could only be what this is about. They can't actually use this money. There's no way to spend billions on yourself. No human being can absorb that, even physically. How many mansions can you have? How big can your yachts be? How many planes do you need? And so it is a certain recklessness that requires a psychological analysis, not only a political analysis.
You place a lot of stock in education, improving the quality and quantity of education in the population. But are there potentially enough jobs available for a more educated population to take, or is the nature of production changed so much technically and geographically that they're just not going to be there?
Right now, we still see a huge return to education, and it's a huge return that shows up in every which way in access to having employment, because the unemployment rate for college grads, a bachelor's degree and higher, is about 4%. For society as a whole, 9%. For those without a high school diploma, more than 14%. We see it in just being in the labor force, because people without enough skills and education just drop out of the labor force entirely. We see it in wage levels and salary levels. We see it in the gains in the past 30 years, where all of the gains have gone to the top. And that means also people with a bachelor's or higher degree. So education's holding up as a good return and a good investment. It's just that kids from poor and middle-class families can't pay for it right now. They can't meet tuition. The Pell Grants keep getting cut back. Tuitions keep going up. State governments, who are at the edge of bankruptcy in many places, are slashing support for state college tuitions and boosting the state universities' charges even, you know, to home state students. So we're seeing that the educational returns are still solid, but it's very hard if you don't have the capital to invest in those returns. We have massive dropouts of our kids from even after they've made it into college. They just don't get a degree. They can't afford it. They can't afford to stick with it. Over time, if everybody in the world became super educated, great. What would happen is productivity everywhere would rise. We'd actually be able to get more work done with fewer hours and have more leisure. And so it could be true that over the long term, the end result of science and technological advances and solid educations is that we're able to get by on less work time, more leisure, and higher compensation when we are working, which wouldn't be an all bad world. But right now, that's not where we are. Right now, we're in a situation where education is just about the only ticket to job security. But we're still graduating roughly one-third of our kids through a four-year bachelor's degree. That means that two-thirds of our kids aren't even getting that ticket into the middle class, and that's what they're feeling. They're feeling the floor fall out from under them.
I believe it was reported in today's Wall Street Journal that half the community college students in New York City don't last longer than 6 months before dropping out. Finally, there's an awful lot that's admirable in your agenda that you call for in the book, but where is the political energy going to come from for implementing the agenda? Is it going to come from popular pressure? Is it going to come from enlightenment among the top 1 to 2%, some combination of the two? How do you see this politically playing out?
The eras that most fascinate me are the progressive era in the United States, which ran after our first Gilded Age, the robber baron era. The progressive era followed from the mid-1890s to U.S. entry in World War I, actually. But we had two great presidents, Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. And they were able to pursue a very progressive agenda against the moneyed interests. They took on the big trust. They took on Standard Oil and Rockefeller. They introduced the income tax as a constitutional amendment and so on, because there was the public that was absolutely energized. There were the muckrakers among the journalists who were doing how the world really worked and how much corruption there was and how bad the moneyed interests had been. And so the progressive era was an example of American renovation. I think FDR and the New Deal was a second example of that, because we swung back in the 1920s to speculation and all of this illusion of the free market under Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. And Roosevelt, again, like his cousin, distant cousin Teddy Roosevelt, came from a wealthy class, but he knew that class, and he was ready to take it on. And America, of course, renovated itself again in the 1960s in civil rights era and the women's rights and sexual and reproductive rights. Our society has rallied against the odds, and it's never been absolutely quick. Some people say, oh, it's a failure, the Occupy movement. You know, 9 weeks, what do they have to show for themselves? This will take years. I believe it's going to have to be a battle of ideas. I think it's going to have to be social activism. I think it's going to have to be shareholder activism. I want people to buy shares in companies and then go to the General Assembly meetings, the shareholder meetings, and say, no, you can't use shareholder money for anonymous political contributions. We've got a lot of shareholder activism ahead that I think can play a big role. And, of course, progressives are going to have to elect people to office. The trick there is that to really be progressive, you can't be dependent on the big money for the campaigns. And so we're going to need nothing less than a new way to win campaigns based on social media, on a massive use of free media, and on a broad society ready for it. And that's part of what we have to create right now, I think, to really go ahead and win elections. You had President Obama claiming to do that in 2008, living on small donations, but we learned after the fact that Wall Street was in there as big bundlers. Now the president is constantly at his $35,800 a plate dinners. He caters to the rich, just like his political opponents do. We need candidates that realize that that's not the way to actually make change in America.
That was Jeffrey Sachs, professor of economics at Columbia and director of its Earth Institute. His new book is called The Price of Civilization from Random House. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Some of the Mekons, "This Funeral is for the Wrong Corpse," a song they wrote to mark the alleged death of socialism back in 1989. Till next week, bye.